Hi, welcome to episode 42 of Yus Kogan's The International Law Podcast. I am your host, Cheyan, and today we are pleased to have been joined by Iran Stoker and Professor Christian Tams to discuss their article titled Swords, Shields, and Other Beasts, The Role of Countermeasures in Investment Arbitration, which was published as part of a special issue on the 20th anniversary of the articles on the responsibility of states for internationally wrongful acts in the Exit Review. Our first guest, Iran Stoker, is a New York-based litigator, consultant, and advisor on matters of public international law. He has vast experience in litigating and advising on complex legal matters such as land and maritime boundaries, the law of the sea, treaty law, investment law, the law of international organizations, human rights law, the use of force, and humanitarian law issues. Iran has worked on cases and appeared before international courts and tribunals, including the International Court of Justice, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, and arbitral tribunals. Dedicated to his belief that advancing the peaceful settlement of disputes and international law more broadly are essential in today's world, he has authored several publications, including the UN Security Council and International Law in 2022, which was co-authored with Sir Michael Wood. He also teaches as an adjunct professor of law at Brooklyn Law School and Seton Hall Law School as well. Thank you, Iran, for joining us. Our second guest is Professor Christian Tams, who is the International Law Chair and the Founding Director of the Glasgow Center for International Law and Security. He has published 17 books as author or editor and approximately 120 articles, books, chapters, and notes on questions of international law, EU law, and German law. These include notably, and my personal favorite, Enforcing Obligations of Omnes, which I think is more relevant now than the time in which it was initially written, the Statute of the International Court of Justice, one of the leading works on the World Court, and finally, a series of collected volumes reflecting on the place of international investment law in the international legal order. In addition to his academic work, Professor Tams has frequently consulted on practical questions of international law. In recent years, he has acted in proceedings before the International Court of Justice, the Iran-US Claims Tribunal, and arbitral tribunals as well, notably in investment cases. Over the past years, he has held visiting positions at universities in France, China, Austria, and Japan. Thank you both for joining us on the podcast for what I'm sure will be a fascinating discussion. To start off and set the scene, I'll hand it over to Iran to give us an overview of the historical origins of countermeasures, their interplay with diplomatic protection, and how international law came to regulate it over time. Over to you.
Well, thank you. First of all, Shan, thank you for having me, for having us. And it's good to see you and to see Christian, my dear friend and sometimes colleague as well, and co-author of this article. So I think a good place for us to start is understanding, since we're talking about countermeasures in the context of investor-state dispute settlement, what are countermeasures? So let's start with that. And then we can talk about what countermeasures are as a sword and shield and diplomatic protection as well. So what are countermeasures? When a state breaches the right of another state, the injured state can then counter that by breaching the rights of the injuring state in return. And if done in accordance with certain conditions, which we'll discuss later on, the injured state will not be responsible for its retaliatory breach of law, its countermeasure. Now, interestingly, historically, it's in the context of protection of investor rights that countermeasures were often used. It wasn't uncommon for Western powers to use force or the threat of force against the host state on the basis of an alleged violation of the investment protections of their nationals in the host state. I should say that using force as a countermeasure, what is known as a reprisal, is no longer legal or part of the doctrine anymore. So countermeasures are a form of self-help, not including recourse to force, in a legal system with traditionally ineffective enforcement mechanisms, taking the law into your own hands, or a form of vigilante justice, if you will. Now, when that's done in the name of the rights of your nationals, it's then done in what's called diplomatic protection. That's when you take the rights of your nationals that were violated and you internationalize them vis-a-vis the violating state. So countermeasures to protect the rights of your nationals, including investors, are p- part of a form of diplomatic protection or exercised when you exercise diplomatic protection. Now, what I just described in terms of countermeasures also reflects what we call the dual role of countermeasures, the sword and the shield. And here we rely on terms used by Professor Paparinskas in an article from 2008 in the British Yearbook of International Law. So a countermeasure is a sword when a state uses it to enforce its international rights. The flip side of that is the fact that the wrongfulness of the breach taken as a countermeasure is precluded. So the state applying a legal countermeasure will be excused or shielded from any responsibility. That's the shield element. So those are the two sides of the coin, so to speak, of countermeasures.
Thank you very much, Iran, for providing us this holistic overview of what I'm sure will be a fascinating discussion. Now, over to Christian. If you could just give us a historical overview and set the timeline for us on how countermeasures came to be, what they are today in the articles on the responsibility of states for the internationally wrongful acts.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Rian, and thanks for having us here. So the timeline, I mean, for countermeasures, it's crucial to look at how they have evolved, because there is massive evolution. It starts with the terms. We now speak of countermeasures in the way that Iran has introduced it, somewhat useful, but perhaps also a bit bland term. It marks a departure from what were referred to as reprisals, armed reprisals or other forms of reprisals, which now in today's parlance sound a bit too aggressive, perhaps, and is avoided as a terminology. And I'm saying that not just to make a terminological point, but because it is intertwined with the history. Reprisals were so much part and parcel of, in particular, 19th century and early 20th century international law, and they were associated with an international law that did not regulate the right of states to use self-help. Iran has mentioned forcible reprisals. There are also non-forcible ones, but both concepts denote the power of states to use self-help to enforce international law when they feel that their rights or rights of their citizens were violated without any need to prove that violation previously. And it was felt in the development that I'll sketch out shortly that this was too open to abuse and required to be reined in. Now, this is not just an abstract feeling about abuse that you often hear about when people talk about international law. It's a very real feeling, because in the 19th century, there were dozens of instances of such self-help, in particular in the field that is now being addressed by international investment law rules. So Newcomb and Paradell in their textbook have an account of this, and they simply summarize what happens, but it's enormous. So the British Navy in the 19th century and early 20th century intervened in Latin America at least 40 times to enforce British claims for injuries to British nationals and to restore order and protect property. So 40 instances of merely in Latin America, British forcible intervention justified by reference to concepts such as reprisals or what we nowadays would call countermeasures. It's very clear that a 20th century and even more so 21st century international law can no longer tolerate this. And so you can read the 20th century legal development as a step-by-step reining in of that potential for self-help. It remains, but it is much curbed now. And so you asked about the timeline. I'm mindful that I've only taken you to the sort of the start, but we can look at this in quick steps. Almost 120 years ago at the Hague conferences, one of the big points that Latin American states made, what they wanted to curb this possibility for gunboat diplomacy, forcible self-help, and they succeeded to some extent because the Drago-Potter Convention, agreed in 1907, limited the right to self-help for the enforcement of contractual debts. Fairly limited, but an important step. And then you have, in the course of the 20th century, for those who know their state responsibility, it's just a repetition, the attempts towards codification and clarification of the rules of countermeasures. The Nauliala arbitration in the 1920s, establishing requirements that govern countermeasures. The charter ban in 1945, the UN charter ban in Article 2.4 on force, which removes the potential for self-help to be forcible outside agreed exceptions, such as self-defense, and therefore takes away the possibility for gunboat diplomacy to be done by gunboats that fire shots. It could still be pressure. You have, after the Second World War, renewed discussion about the limits of countermeasures. And then you have the switch towards the work of the International Law Commission on state responsibility, which comes to articulate for the first time in written form a legal framework governing countermeasures in Articles 49 to 54, which stipulates that they must be proportionate, commensurate to the injury caused, that prior notification must be given, that they must be reversible. So that's our current standpoint for countermeasures. The ILC's text of 2001 that you alluded to, Shuyan, on state responsibility, that is for present purposes, the, I wouldn't say the Magna Carta, but perhaps the most, the clearest articulation of the rules governing countermeasures, enshrining that the fact that countermeasures must no longer be forcible.
I see. Thank you very much for the comprehensive mapping. I'll now refer to the articles on state responsibility as either that or our SIVA, just to not make our listeners go through the pain of going through the very long name over and over again. But on that note, I'll turn to Iran as well on questions specifically relating to the framework that you've just alluded to. But before that, I had a question of personal curiosity, which Iran, either you or Professor Tams, please feel free to jump in. On page 24, and I quote, you mentioned the articulation of the countermeasures was not a straightforward process. Aspects of it indeed proved vexed, and on at least two occasions, disputes about the proper approach risk derailing the commission's project. Could either of you please shed more light on this quote, and in particular, what were those two approaches that you alluded to? Christian, over to you.
Okay, I mean, this proved contentious. I mean, I put it perhaps too firmly as sort of the successful codification. And I think with 20 years of hindsight to the ILC's text, our SIVA or ILC articles, whatever your current, your preferred shortened version, we see it, I think, as a successful attempt in clarification. But it was deeply controversial at the time. So two examples I could give. In the 1990s, this is well before the work on state responsibility entered this final dramatic phase with under the rapporteurship of James Crawford. There were attempts by a predecessor of James Crawford, Gaetano Aranjuez Ruiz, recently passed away, to formulate a more restrictive regime of countermeasures that required prior exhaustion of dispute resolution. That was, I think, that appealed to many international lawyers who see the discipline as taming interstate self-help, but it many members foresaw that this text would never be acceptable to states. And so there was a massive clash and massive debates within the ILC, which were one factor among many that led to the resignation of that particular special rapporteur. And then more recently, in the dying days of the ILC's project, there was a massive debate on something that is not directly relevant to our topic today, but that goes back to a work that you were kind enough to refer to, Shayan, in the opening, erga omnes and public interests. Can you enforce public interests by way of countermeasures? The ILC thought so. Many states were a bit more cautious. So on the question of whether states that are not directly injured can take countermeasures in defense of public interests, the ILC text in a famous or infamous provision, Article 54, is rather lukewarm and says whatever you want to read in it. That was a compromise which was reached in order to prevent a last-minute failure of the text, which might have been a real issue had the ILC been more robust and come out in favor of a recognition of such a right to take countermeasures in the public interest. A final point, that was a position I would have much preferred, and who knows, we may be at some point reaching that position, but not in 2001, not in the ILC's text.
I know in your book on erga omnes, you're fairly vocal about the second approach, at least. And Iran, my apologies for distracting us from the topic at hand. This was a question of personal curiosity which I had about the Law Commission, but we'll come back to you on sort of what you term as the four main features of the ILC framework, which are relevant for the discussion today. So I'll hand it over to you to sort of give us and give the listeners an overview on what those four features are, or four relevant aspects are for the discussion today.
Right. Thank you, Shan. And essentially, this is just going to give a little more content to what Christian already mentioned in terms of some of the conditions and curtailing of the doctrine of countermeasures within the ILC articles. So let's talk in 4 points about the specific articles dealing with countermeasures and that are relevant for our discussion. So the specific provisions are found in Part 3, Chapter 1 of the articles on the invocation of the responsibility of the state. So first off, Article 49, it's on the objects and limits of countermeasures, and it reflects the ILC's understanding of what we call countermeasures as a sword. A state may enact a countermeasure against, and I quote, a state which is responsible for an internationally wrongful act in order to induce that state to comply with its obligations, end of quote. So you do it in order to enforce your international rights. Now, furthermore, the countermeasure you choose doesn't have to be from the same field of law or from the same treaty as the original breach. It can be from a completely different set of international rights and obligations. And the state taking countermeasures is then left with pretty wide discretion as to what type of countermeasure it chooses, as long as it meets the conditions enumerated in the articles. So what are those conditions? And this is the second point. Article 50 provides a list of fundamental obligations of the state that cannot be affected by its chosen countermeasure. And these are Jus Cogens obligations, for example, or human rights obligations. These are some of those listed. In terms of other substantive limitations, Christian mentioned these before, the countermeasure must terminate as soon as compliance is achieved. That's Article 53. It generally needs to be one that can be reversed once compliance is achieved, because that's the whole purpose, to induce compliance. That's in Article 49.3. And it must be proportionate. That's in Article 51. Christian referred to the famous Nalila case. It was proportionality was mentioned there. It's also in the ICJ's jurisprudence on countermeasures. There are also procedural requirements a state must comply with when enacting a countermeasure. It must first call on the breaching state to comply with its obligations and then notify the state of its decision to enact countermeasures if there's still no compliance, and that's in Article 52. Thirdly, Article 22 reflects the idea of countermeasures as a shield, meaning that when a state properly applies the doctrine, the wrongfulness of the act is precluded or excused. And finally, fourth is the relevance of a more general article, not specifically about countermeasures, but one of the general provisions of the draft articles. That's Article 55 and how it relates to countermeasures. Professor Tams, I believe, will get back to this when we talk about countermeasures as a sword. But generally speaking, Article 55, it states that the rules enumerated in the draft articles are of a residual nature, and they apply to the extent that they're not governed by special rules or what we call lex specialis. So those are the four sort of relevant key points that we have from the articles themselves that govern the doctrine of countermeasures.
And just as a quick follow-up, if we could get some examples on how sort of Article 55 really operates in practice, and if there are some regimes which you could also help us look to get a better sense of how Article 55 operates, I think that could be helpful as well.
Definitely. So going back to this idea of residual regimes and lex specialis, the commentaries to the draft articles of the ILC explain that it's the rules of the special regime that dictate the extent of the application of the draft article to that regime. So the answer is found in the special regime. Now, with respect to countermeasures specifically, the ILC recognized in the commentary, that states can agree in a treaty, for example, to exclude the applicability of the articles to a specific regime and the availability of countermeasures to that regime. Now, what all of this means is that in the investment law regime itself, that regime will provide an answer about the availability of countermeasures, at least in order to enforce and protect investment rights. Now, we do have a couple of examples of the application of the articles on the ways to invoke responsibility of others considered in a couple of special regimes. So first, in the human rights context, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, provides for a mechanism where states can raise other states' human rights violations in Article 41. But there are three caveats to its application. First, you have to opt into this mechanism. Second, the mechanism does not produce any binding results. And third, in practice, states have avoided utilizing the mechanism against other states. If I'm not mistaken, there's no examples of its invocation to this date. Now, in General Comment 31, the Human Rights Committee, which is the body that monitors the implementation of the ICCPR, it explained that just because the mechanism is potentially available does not exclude other avenues of invoking state responsibility for human rights violations outside of this special regime. So there's still that residual effect of the articles in that regime. Now, you can compare that to trade law, where in a Section 301 case, which was before a WTO panel, here the panel concluded, reached the opposite conclusion. So it said that when the members adopted the dispute settlement mechanism, the DSU, under the WTO, that implied that states are excluded from taking unilateral measures against other states to enforce their WTO rights. In other words, just like envisioned in Article 55 of the draft articles, the lex specialis, in this case, trade law, excluded countermeasures to enforce rights and obligations of the regime. And this was even without an explicit treaty provision to that effect. So it was by implication. So here we have two special regimes addressing the residual effect of the articles, and particularly in the context of invoking state responsibility and the usage of countermeasures.
Thank you to both of you for setting or giving us a context of the discussion which is to follow, which is really the core of the article about swords and shields. So I suppose we can start with the swords part first. Christian, in the context of investment arbitration, what exactly does countermeasures as a sword mean? And perhaps it might be helpful for the listeners if you can frame the answer in the context of Article 27 of the ICSID Convention and its intersection with Article 55 of CEWA.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Shayan. I mean, to start perhaps with a hypothetical, I mean, normally countermeasures are available to states of nationality in defense of their nationals. So just assume that a home state to an investor breaches the investor's rights. Take the classic case of nationalization, collectivization, expropriation, but any other breach might qualify. Now, in that setting, normally and under the traditional rules, the home state would be perfectly entitled to take countermeasures and, let's say, suspend treaty benefits vis-a-vis that home state and protect the rights of its national. Now, no longer forcibly, of course, but the potential for countermeasures remains there. And if you look around and you look at the exposure of investors to home state measures, this is a source of a real problem potentially. Now, nothing, to come back to points that Iran made, nothing in the text of the ICSID Convention or of BIT expressly precludes such measures. But as we say in the article, the better argument suggests that at least in certain circumstances, it's by necessary implication that the power of the home state to take countermeasures is eclipsed or precluded or suspended for certain measures. And that is, to come back to your point, Shayan, what is, I think, the inevitable result from Article 27 of the ICSID Convention. Now, that provision is not, I'm not expecting all of our readers to have memorized it by heart. I haven't memorized it by heart, but it is part of what you might say the fundamental deal underlying the ICSID Convention and investment arbitration more generally. So the idea is that in the 1960s, states began to reach agreement on a framework whereby such disputes of the sort I've sketched out would no longer be primarily fought out, if you forgive the military technology, between the states, but the investor itself would be empowered. The investor itself would have a right to take recourse against the home state that had allegedly expropriated or violated the FET standard. And not only would the investor have that right, it would also have that right to go to a very attractive forum, international arbitration. So that's, if you want, the basic deal of investment arbitration. That's why we're having all these cases. Now, I think countermeasures as a sort, or the unavailability of countermeasures as a sort, is the necessary flip side of that. Because if the investor can act himself or itself or herself, it's almost inevitable that the home state should no longer be able to defend the rights of the investor. And this is what Article 27 says, and in fact says more. It says that the contracting states shall not give diplomatic protection in the event where the investor itself pursues its rights before investment arbitration tribunals. And that is it's often forgotten nowadays because we're so accustomed to investment arbitration, but that is the fundamental deal. That is why so many states were willing to accept such an intrusive framework. Yes, investors would have a right to go to arbitration, but the price for that would be that home states would be out of that equation. They would no longer be able to exercise diplomatic protection for their investors, and certainly they would no longer be able to exercise diplomatic protection coercively through means of countermeasures. Now, that's the basic framework, and this is what results, and I think what is recognized in Article 27 of the ICSID Convention that you referred to. I would perhaps say it's hardly ever litigated because it seems to be, I think it's internalized. I think it is clear. To the extent that we have jurisprudence on this point or case law on this point, I think we have statements from certain cases where it is said that the right to exercise diplomatic protection in its entirety goes as long as the investor files for arbitration. And that then must also mean the right to exercise diplomatic protection by means of countermeasures. We have that from the early days of the AMCO annulment decision, that this is relatively clear. Now, I'm happy to speak about limitations because it's not a sort of a wholesale exclusion, but this is the starting premise. If the investor goes for arbitration, the countermeasures, the state of nationality can no longer use countermeasures as a sword.
And just as a follow-up on when the investor goes to arbitration. So Article 27 in part also reads as shall have consented to submit or shall have submitted to arbitration under this convention. So if you could shed a bit more light on when the consent gets perfected to a point where it precludes the use of countermeasures by the home state.
Yeah, and I think you're right to draw attention to that because, of course, the granting of consent when the ICSID Convention was written was assumed to be in a contract primarily. Nowadays, with the rise of investment treaty arbitration, investment lawyers have had to be somewhat creative to find consent between the parties where two states have agreed to a BIT and an investor that is not party to that BIT somehow avails itself of that consent. I mean, the basic construction that investment lawyers work with, and if you want, that has kept investment law going for the last 40 years, helps us here. So the idea that consent is perfected at the moment at which the investor files for arbitration, because then the investor would agree to the standing offer to arbitration made by the host state in the BIT and made by the host state to any investor from the other side in the BIT. So that is the slightly artificial but very workable construction on which all of investment treaty arbitration is based, and it applies here. So it is at the moment at which an investor files for arbitration that the right to take countermeasures as a sword would be, if you want, eclipsed. But there is, if I may, also a limitation in time. And that is perhaps even clearer. And that is, in fact, expressly noted in the second paragraph of Article 27. So countermeasures cannot be taken as long as the arbitration process continues. But when, of course, the possibility is there that the host state fails to comply, with the award rendered perhaps in favor of an investor, then the right of the home state to exercise diplomatic protection revives again. And it revives not just as a new right to exercise diplomatic protection with writing letters or formulating protests, but including the right to assist national investors through countermeasures. And this is expressly said in the second phrase of Article 27, paragraph 1. The exclusion is there unless, and I'm quoting, the contracting state shall have failed to abide by and comply with the award rendered in such a dispute. So we have a relatively clear starting point. Countermeasures become unavailable when the investor goes for arbitration. And we have a very clear ending point. The power to take countermeasures as a sort revives if and when the host state fails to abide by and comply with awards rendered in favor of investors.
So picking up on this point, it seems to me that, as you mentioned as well, it's only eclipsed and sort of activates once again as soon as there is non-compliance of an award. But when we talk about non-compliance, what exactly do we mean? And to sort of give a bit more context or to borrow the wording from the article, when do exit procedures really fail within the meaning of the convention? And of course, there are some very obvious cases where there is clear non-compliance, but there might be some gray areas as well. So when we say when we really talk about the procedures failing or the non-compliance happening, how do we ascertain the point in time where it is clear that non-compliance has happened in, let's say, for example, gray areas, not so much the clearer ones?
I mean, I doubt that Article 27 and the interplay with Article 55 of the ILC RCBA framework will provide very clear answers here. They offer pointers, and I think they take positions of principle which are important, that for the duration of an arbitral process, no countermeasures must be taken. I think we can proceed if we take the language of Article 27, failure to comply, relatively clearly by indications from the exit convention itself. The award is binding upon the state when it is rendered. The tribunal may give the host state some time to implement it. But in principle, it is an obligation that is articulated in the award and binding upon the host state with the award. Now, the exit convention also has means of seeking annulment. So, of course, as long as an annulment process is pending, the duty would not exist, or that there would be no failure to comply and no power to take countermeasures. But once those means are exhausted, the power to take countermeasures revives. And if I may make one point, Shayan, this is also, I mean, this sounds as if it's just suspended, and it is. But of course, this suspension is crucial, because why were so many people concerned about the rampant power of reprisals in the 19th century, partly because it was forcible, that's no longer an option, but partly also because it was the gunboat diplomacy states that interpreted the law. Britain thought rights of British nationals had been violated. There was no impartial test or assessment. So I have relatively few problems with the right to take countermeasures non-forcibly to revive, because in the setting that Article 27 refers to, we have in the interim an arbitral process that delivers an impartial binding outcome. We have exactly sort of an impartial evaluation that was missing in many of the cases that are so infamous from the 19th century, where the powerful states from Europe took the power and the right in their own hands. Here we have a crucial interim stage of arbitration by an impartial tribunal. This is why I think the revival is justified and plausible.
Right. So up until now, we've focused on specifically Article 27 of the Exit Convention. So if we go outside the Exit framework and apply this by analogy to non-Exit proceedings, how do you think this would play out there?
Well, it is more controversial, because, of course, the argument that I've sketched out, I mean, I think gains prominence because there is a foothold in Article 27 of the Exit Convention. And the Exit Convention expressly excludes diplomatic protection, so it must also exclude coercive diplomatic protection through countermeasures. Outside the Exit, you don't have any equivalence to Article 27. So the argument is more difficult to make, or an argument, as Iran and I are making it in the article, for a suspension or eclipse, as you say, Shayan, of countermeasures during the arbitration proceedings is more needs to be made more tentatively. It does seem to me that it can be made nonetheless, because what I have tried to bring out is, if you want, inherent in the logic of investment arbitration. And Article 27 reflects, codifies, and spells out that logic. But I don't think a provision such as Article 27 is constitutive. I think you can deduce from the fact that, let's say, an investor goes to UNCITRAL, that UNCITRAL empowers an investor the same preclusion of home state measures that Article 27 gives us very clearly and expressly. Now, that point is more controversial, and the counter-argument is obvious. You cannot just invent or read into a framework that doesn't say so, a power to take a provision that takes away your power to take countermeasures. But I would think there are two points that justify this. I'll mention them briefly. One is the essential parallelism of ICSID and non-ICSID investment arbitration. There are nuances, but the foundational ideas are the same. And Article 55 doesn't require preclusions to be expressed. It can work with implied exclusions of Article 55 of the state responsibility framework permits preclusion through implicit opting out, if you want. And then we have at least some indication that the tribunals, for example, in a case between Italy and Cuba, one of the rare interstate cases based on investment treaty law, have accepted as much. So they were willing to treat ICSID and non-ICSID awards in parallel, which in our reading, as we've set out in the article, would mean then also outside ICSID, countermeasures are precluded as long as arbitration proceedings continue, and then they revive if there's non-compliance, but only then.
Right. Iran, we've now heard comprehensively from Christian on how countermeasures operate as a sword. Can we turn over to you on how they operate as a shield? And perhaps, like Christian, if you could start with an example or a context setting hypothetical, I think that would be helpful for the listeners.
Of course. So actually here, much like Christian's work on Erga Omnes, we have a lot of timely examples. So there have been a variety of legal justifications offered to justify sanctions imposed by some states on Russia in the context of the Ukraine conflict, for example. Now, one of those justifications being given is that these sanctions are a form of countermeasures. Now, whether or not the doctrine can justify the violations of obligations owed to Russia, that's one thing. But to the extent that these sanctions have violated the protections owed to Russian private investors, can they be excused on the basis that they are actually countermeasures against Russia? And to take it further, when a Russian investor will make a claim that their investment protection has been violated before an arbitral tribunal, can the sanctioning states say or claim that they are excused because the violations were in fact countermeasures against Russia? Now, that's the question of countermeasures as a shield in the investment law context. So essentially, we're talking about a situation where one state violates the rights of another state, and that doesn't necessarily happen in the investment field. And then the state with the rights that were breached decides to adopt a countermeasure in response. And the countermeasure is the one that's suspending investment protections owned under, for example, a BIT, bilateral investment treaty, to the nationals of the original violating state. So it's the countermeasure here, as opposed to the sword situation that Christian was talking about. Here, it's the countermeasure, not the initial violation that potentially violates the investment rights. The original violation could be from a completely different regime. Now, just to add to that when we're looking at the legality of countermeasures as a shield, as opposed to a sword in investment law, now, assessing whether the investment regime, like we did, like Christian example gave the example, assessing the logic of the investment regime and the incentives and why we have the structures we have, for example, in Article 27, is really immaterial. Now, why is that? Because we're not here talking about part of that deal that Christian was describing in Article 27 and then applicable to other investment regimes. That's because we're not trying to assess that regime and whether it has effective tools to enforce investment rights to the exclusion by implication or by treaty of countermeasures. Here, the state is not trying to enforce the investment rights at all. It's actually excusing a violation of investment protections as a countermeasure. So here, the problem really becomes a different one, and that's the potential rights of third parties affected by countermeasures, which are applied usually between two states. And that's really the crux of the difficulty that we try to evaluate when we talk about countermeasures as a shield in the investment context.
Right. I think as we progress further in the discussion, we'll also have some NAFTA cases which give us an even stronger sense of what exactly is it when we talk about countermeasures as a shield. And on that note, you also refer to varying approaches on this point in the article as well. Maybe just to set us off on the varying approaches, we can start with perhaps the ILC's framework and then move over to NAFTA subsequently.
Right. Let's start indeed with what the ILC articles can tell us about this issue of countermeasures as a shield, and then we can sort of see how the different reading of those articles are reflected in the little NAFTA case law we have on this issue. So what did the ILC articles on countermeasures tell us about protection of investors' rights? So as I mentioned earlier, the articles are found in a chapter that concerns the invocation of the responsibility of states specifically. And Article 49.1 is clearly concerned with countermeasures only against the state responsible for the initial breach of the law, to the exclusion of the application of countermeasures towards specifically third states. Now, furthermore, as we already mentioned, investor rights are not mentioned in that list of protected rights in Article 50, Human Rights, Uskogens, IHL. The commentaries to the articles explicitly recognize that countermeasures between states could produce indirect and collateral damage on private businesses and individuals. And maybe investors are some of those individuals. So it seemed that the draft articles adopt sort of a more traditional approach to international law. That's really because they seem to be focusing on countermeasures as a purely interstate concept, right? Now, at the same time, and this relates a bit to what Christian was talking about as to the wider rationale or sensibilities or why the system is the way it is, if the rationale here in the articles and the logic of countermeasures that are supposed to apply between the violating state and the state responding, if the rationale here is the protection of third party rights more generally, right? You only enact countermeasures against the state that's violated your rights, and this has some support in the commentaries themselves, then why not protection of other third parties, like third party investors? And these two different readings of the articles, now they bring us to sort of a wider issue that we bring up in the beginning of our article, and that's, what's the status of the individual as a subject of international law, right? International law, in the very literal sense, is the law of nations. It used to be solely focused on the law, the rights and obligations of states vis-a-vis each other. But today we have other subjects of international law, international organizations, individuals or other private legal entities. And they have rights and obligations. So, for example, obligations in international criminal law. But they also have rights, such as human rights. And this is something that started developing primarily in the middle of the 20th century. Before that, to an extent, but that's really where it really caught on. And so in the context of investment, in the investment regime, the question is, does the investment regime create rights for investors independent of their state? Now, if that's true, then countermeasures between two states should not violate the rights of third parties, the investors. Or are the investment protections state rights only? If this is the case, then the harm caused to the investors by countermeasures is not a violation of third party rights. It stays completely in the realm of interstate countermeasures. Now, as I was saying, the different ways of understanding the these fundamentals of the investment protection regime are reflected in the little NAFTA jurisprudence we have on the issue. And here we're really talking about three cases from about 15 years ago that all relate to the same factual backdrop. So let me just explain the facts. In short, this was a case where Mexico applied a tax on soft drinks with high fructose corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup was exported by US producers. It's a sugar substitute. It was exported by American producers, which they argued that the tax hurt their investment in local Mexican companies, which were distributing and marketing the product in Mexico. In response, Mexico argued before the tribunals that the tax was a lawful countermeasure against the U.S. for violating NAFTA. And they claimed, Mexico claimed that the U.S. was violating NAFTA by blocking Mexican sugar producers from U.S. market. And sugar is a very big industry in Mexico. Now, in other words, Mexico was applying countermeasure as a shield against the U.S. with negative effect on American private investors. So that's the factual backdrop that relates to these three cases. Now, turning to the awards, the tribunals differ from each other in their approach towards the nature of the investor rights under the investment regime. In the ADM case, the first case, the tribunal found that the investor has certain procedural rights, such as initiating arbitration, but the substantive protection of NAFTA of the investment regime are exclusively that of the state. And therefore, the tribunal saw no reason why Mexico couldn't resort to countermeasures at the expense of American investors, though it then concluded that Mexico didn't, in fact, meet the conditions of a lawful countermeasure under customary law, as reflected in the ILC articles we spoke about, such as proportionality. The arbitral tribunals in the two other cases reached the opposite conclusion about the nature of the rights, albeit in a slightly different way. In the corn products case, the tribunal recognized or categorized the investors' rights as substantive. And again, relying on the work of the ILC, concluded that whatever countermeasure Mexico adopts against the US, that cannot excuse the violation of the substantive third-party rights of American investors. The Cargill Tribunal, the final case, reached a similar conclusion, the only difference being that instead of categorizing the rights of the US investors as substantive or procedural, it simply asserted that the American investor rights were independent of that of the US, and thus, again, they are third-party rights, which cannot be subject to countermeasures between Mexico and the United States. So we see that these two approaches to the question whether investors have their own rights within the investment regime, leading to two opposing answers as to whether a state can use countermeasures as a shield in the investment law context.
Thank you for the comprehensive answer. I see that you mentioned diverging approaches. So give us a sense of what you think the answer is or should be. And you particularly mentioned the term triangular nature of investment treaties. So I'm curious to hear what your take is on where the answer should fall.
Sure. So first of all, let me start that with a bit of a disclaimer, and just to say that we're not inventing the wheel here, or we didn't discover penicillin. We're just trying to offer or suggest perhaps another way to look at the issue. So we're not saying this is the answer, the definite answer. We don't expect to win a Nobel Prize or anything, but perhaps there are other ways other than conventional ways to think about it. And it's more, the article is more a start of a conversation, I think, on this point. And the reason we got to the solution, or we suggest looking at a different way to look at things, is because the debate about who the rights belong to has been going on for a while, and it's not going away. So we wanted to think about whether there's a possibility to answer this question, which is not necessarily dependent on the owner of the rights. So instead of focusing on to whom the rights belong, we suggest a possible focus on the scope of the rights or protections afforded to investors within this three-pronged or triangular relationship, and triangular between because it's between two states establishing the rights in a BIT, for example, and the investor. And here we also refer to work by Anthea Roberts, and she called this the third-party beneficiary paradigm. So in essence, the idea is this. Whatever the nature of the rights given to investors, the beneficiaries of these rights, in a treaty, those rights are still confined to the scope and limits of the rights of the states granting them. So in the relationship between two states, a state will not be held responsible for violating the investment treaty if it was a lawful countermeasure, right? That much is clear and uncontroversial, I think. Now, that shouldn't change just because those rights were then given to someone else, in this case, the investor. The nature of the right remains the same, even if the right was to the benefit of a third party. Now, let me here, to try and make this a little clearer, use an example from property law or a property law analogy to demonstrate what we mean. So let's say I buy a house with a lien on it, a mortgage, for Professor Thames, because I'm a very generous person. Now, when I give him the house, the mortgage doesn't go away, right? It's still attached to the property, to the house. So I give it to him with the mortgage attached. So let me throw in some land here, right? Nemo dat quod non habet, you cannot give more than what you have. What's a podcast without Latin about international law? So the same here. I, the state, sign a treaty, the treaty that gives rights, investment protections. I agree with the other state that I'll give those rights to its nationals. And so now I owe those protections to the investors. But unless we agreed otherwise, which we of course can, the rights I have to give were not immune from countermeasures or the mortgage. And so the nature of the rights that are now with the investor haven't changed and remain essentially exposed to potential countermeasures in the future. So again, here we're thinking it doesn't necessarily matter if these are individual rights or state rights still that investors enjoy. And we saw that split in the NAFTA jurisprudence. Maybe it's more an issue of what the rights are, what their scope and limits are. And that's sort of a different way of thinking or a different way to tackle the question that we suggest could be helpful.
Thank you, Iran, for this very helpful analogy. I wish my property law professor was as clear as you were just now. But no, in all seriousness, thank you to you and Christian for navigating us through these complex issues. I'll now turn it to you, Christian, to conclude. If you could summarize the discussion and give our listeners a sense of how the ILC's work sort of fits into the broader picture of swords and shields.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Shayan. Well, I mean, that we've covered quite a lot of ground, so the summary will be a summary. I think that maybe if I can start with one sort of more, I mean, really sort of stepping back, big picture point. I mean, I think what we've tried to do in the article, and perhaps it's come clear, become clear in the discussion, is really sort of to look at countermeasures as how does an old world, not old world Europe, but a 19th century traditional international law vehicle tool fit into this glitzy modern world of investment arbitration. So I think that's the clash that we have. I mean, if you ask investment arbitration lawyers listening to this podcast, I mean, they will not really be the ones who work with countermeasures all the time. If you're sort of ingrained in the sort of the investment arbitration world, you have other things to do. You have sort of 3 million FET claims to memorize, and you have disclosures to deal with and documents to produce. Countermeasures may be not top of your list. So that's the tension with which we started and which prompted us to reflect on this. And I think the outcome is that, I mean, in very broad brush strokes, that there is room for countermeasures, limited room, but some room for countermeasures, even in this glitzy new world. Now, not in the middle of an arbitration hearing or rarely in the middle of an arbitration hearing, but conceptually. So investment arbitration is in some ways a world unto itself, but the investment relationship that's regulated by international law does leave room for countermeasures here and there. Now, with respect to swords, I've tried to sketch that out prior to the arbitration, perhaps, certainly after the arbitration if there's non-compliance. For shields, Aaron has just explained to us where the room might be, and I think it might be there, contrary to some NAFTA tribunals rushing to read out countermeasures from the investment from the investment arbitration NAFTA relationship. We think that is somewhat premature, and they shouldn't be easily precluded. So there is room, and maybe that's then the, I mean, for people who are getting old like myself, maybe that's the empowering message that old tools occasionally can still be useful, even in new glitzy modern worlds where they otherwise feel out of place. So that's the big takeaway in somewhat flippant terms, which I think is the main takeaway from our article. Now, you asked, Cheyenne, about the ILC and where the ILC fits. And maybe just a word on this, because, of course, I know that your listeners and you yourself are ILC aficionados. I've listened to sort of episodes you've done with Dapo, with Dana Azaria about the ILC and its role. So in some ways, our piece is also, while looking at countermeasures, it's also about the ILC, because the ILC has written the modern script for countermeasures. What can we learn from our discussion about the ILC's work on state responsibility? I think there's two things. So one is the ILC's regulation of countermeasures was written without investment arbitration at the forefront. And that's very clear. I think Eyan spoke to this. It's written with a state-to-state mindset, and investment arbitration with this triangular relationship doesn't fit easily. I think for the aspect I've been dealing with, the sword aspect, I think the ILC regime yields a relatively clear answer. It allows for opting out, and I think it's pretty straightforward that at least during the duration of investment arbitration, investment law does opt out, so countermeasures are no longer available. But the shield aspect that Iran was speaking to, it's a bit more difficult to exactly sort of come up with. I think there's a reason in the ILC's text why tribunals were arguing over the matter. It's not as clear as it should be, but we think it can be read with some goodwill and some general international law grounding properly, and then it will not lead to a reading out of countermeasures. So what are the two points? A conservative interstate framework for dealing with state responsibility isn't perfectly suited to give perfect answers to the question of countermeasures in investment arbitration. But the magic of the ILC's success is such a versatile topic, such an openness towards opting out, fine-tuning, finessing in special rules, such a focus on enabling interaction between the general framework of state responsibility and the specific frameworks in the fields where responsibility is invoked, that plausible solutions can be produced and can be argued for. So it's versatile. It's structurally conservative, but versatile. And that versatility, I think, ensures its continued life in these debates and makes sure that we can still work with the state responsibility framework, even when we're looking at investment law debates. That's all I would want to say by way of summary and assessing the role of the ILC. Many thanks.
And this brings the episode to an end. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Goodbye.